very much. Thank you. Thanks very much indeed, Adrian. Thanks to all of you for turning up in such large numbers this evening to come to this event. I'd like to start this sort of brief talk, and that's all it is, just to set the framework for what I hope will be a lot of sort of questions from you and debate, and I'll try and answer them as well as I can, by saying and pointing out to you perhaps some of the reasons, the point of departure for writing Revolution Day. And I was quite worried in some ways back in the summer when I decided to write a book about the experiences, not just of the war, but of the 6 years that I've been traveling to and reporting from Iraq. And worried because I knew very, very clearly from right at the beginning what kind of book I wanted to write. Worried because this was my first book. it had only been a few weeks after what had been a very emotionally and physically draining experience over the previous, not just the previous 4 weeks of the war itself, but in the whole year of the run-up to the war, in which I and about six other colleagues from the BBC tried to sort of explain and clarify every twist and turn in the run-up to the war. And I knew that I wanted to write it, as Adrian was pointing out in the subtitle of the book, for it to be a human story in the sense of a portrayal of Iraq really beyond the public image of the war and the image of the country, which had been defined largely by Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath Party. And it really comes from that a very, very definitive week, I think, almost a year ago, from when the capital, Baghdad, fell, and 5 days afterwards, when American forces tried to extend their rule. Now, on April the 9th of last year was the one event, I suppose, if you could sort of point to one thing with which I have been very, very identified, and that was the sort of the tearing down of the statue of Saddam Hussein, the infamous one in Firdous Square. And I'm sure there'll be lots of questions wanting a bit more of an explanation of that day and that event. But it was an absolutely critical 5 days of what followed from that day, April the 9th, to about sort of April the 14th, 15th, because it has set the context of what has happened over the last 12 years, what regime change has meant from the point of view of the governments in London and Washington, and set against that from the point of view of ordinary Iraqis. What did regime change, this war that was built around that issue as a title, within which there were, of course, other issues like weapons of mass destruction, but it boiled down to the idea that Britain and the United States wanted to embark on a military campaign to overthrow the Saddam Hussein regime. Now, on April the 9th, when the statue came down, that was the defining and iconic moment, I suppose, from London and Washington of the military success of the invasion. At that point, they could say their plans for the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, to cut off any particular nexus or possible link with Al-Qaeda, and was severed. The possible harboring and possible use of weapons of mass destruction, those mythical things that have been searched for and not found in Iraq, the possibility had been ended. But what did regime change mean beyond that for ordinary Iraqis? How has the war defined their society? What kind of new country has the war bequeathed to them? Now, what was, for the British and American governments, this iconic moment, the coming down of the statue of in Firdous Square, was replaced the very next day by what regime change has come to really mean for ordinary Iraqis, and what the story of the last 12 months since the war has been for ordinary Iraqis. And that was the extensive looting and pillaging that we saw in Baghdad. Because underneath that, it reveals, I suppose, the hollow shell that regime change was for ordinary Iraqis. There wasn't an ability to see beyond the obsession that London and Washington had with Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath Party and the so-called external threats that he posed to the world, Britain and the United States. Regime change was a hollow shell and has proved to be a hollow shell for ordinary Iraqis, because They never really lay beyond the wishes to overthrow the regime a clear definition of what country London and Washington wanted Iraq to inherit and the plans that was going to provide ordinary Iraqis with the means to achieve that post-Saddam era. Now, one of the things that I think those 4 or 5 days that followed the fall of Baghdad also defined was the, I mean, apart from the obvious lack of preparation for what happened after the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, was a lot of the, I suppose, bread and butter issues by which Iraqis were always going to judge what the achievements of the war had been for them. I think it revealed the inability of the coalition forces, the American and British military presence in Iraq, to provide a semblance of security for ordinary Iraqis, who were, I mean, let's not delude ourselves, who were absolutely ecstatic to see the back of the regime that had led them to such a trauma over 25 years. And don't forget, the majority of Iraqis are under 25 years old, so the majority of Iraqis have quite literally known nothing other than the brutal world that the Ba'ath Party had made, that had constructed in Iraq. But beyond that, the fall of Saddam Hussein and his regime had been replaced for ordinary Iraqis by, in some senses, it's been described as a sort of new tyranny, that of insecurity, that of a lack of the basic fundamental building blocks that makes a civil society. And I think ordinary Iraqis, when they talked about and when we talked to them about what they made of regime change, and it was difficult talking to Iraqis in an open way under the regime because of the nature of the dictatorship, but because I had been traveling there for so long and had been able to sort of strike up a lot of friendships based on trust with ordinary Iraqis, it allowed me the ability to question some friends what did regime change mean to them. And I think the one thing that I suppose, apart from curious sort of scratching of the heads because it hadn't been explained to them in anything more than that, there were two things that they reacted to. One was a sense of unease. What did regime change? Did that mean that anyone who was a member of the Ba'ath Party was somehow not going to play a role in the future of Iraq, which was odd because, I mean, to be anything in Iraq, I mean, to be a nurse or a teacher or a member of a hospital, even to get into some of the better universities, one had to either be a member of the Ba'ath Party or to be children attached to senior members of the regime. But also, I suppose, that conjured up for them the sense that after the tanks and the armored personnel carriers would come an army of civil administrators, of humanitarian relief workers that would undo the enormous damage that had been done in Iraq, not just by the war, but by 10 years of the most restrictive economic sanctions in the United Nations history. And I believe that the voices of ordinary Iraqis now, more than at any other time, especially looking back a year, is critical for us to hear, because through those ordinary voices, I think one can begin to appreciate, first of all, what the war, not only what the war promised, but what the occupation has so far failed to deliver on. Because, of course, all wars are consequential, but this war has enormous consequences, first of all for ordinary Iraqis, but also for us, in terms of, as Adrian was saying, what was done in our name, but also how we project our power, how international security institutions are going to live up to the obligations and the charters that reflect our democratic instincts and desires. And I think the story of the last 12 years has shown, the last 12 months, I should say, has shown that in terms of the central question of was the war worth it, and I'm sure this is an issue that we're all going to get into, was the war worth it, or more specifically, what has the war achieved? At the heart of it lies the voices of ordinary Iraqis and what they believe they have, whether they are able to have built a new Iraq that is free not just of the past and the traumas of Saddam Hussein, but that is an Iraq that has allowed them for the first time in a generation and more to to, I suppose, allow themselves to believe that their children will not live the same life and the same kind of appalling repression and dictatorship that they had to live through. It's very easy, I think, here in the United Kingdom, particularly over the last sort of 12 years, as we have seen the war in Iraq, as it has reflected back to us in our society, of the questions of weapons of mass destruction, of the questions about the legality of the war, and so forth, to look beyond that to say, well, what is happening in Iraq, and what difference has the war made to ordinary Iraqis? Because only through that, I think, will we get some of the answers that that all of us want to hear. I observed, as I said, the run-up to the war from the perspective of Baghdad, from March of 2002 through to when the war ended in April. I think I and a lot of my colleagues, British colleagues who remained in Baghdad, were conscious that we were broadcasting back to and reporting back to a country that was divided on the issue of the war. But I think I don't want to speak for my other colleagues, but speaking for myself, I had not appreciated just how deep those divisions were, and it's only since having come back to live in the United Kingdom since the summer of last year, when I began to write the book, that I was able to see just how strong the passions before the war were and how deep the divisions are subsequent to the end of the war. I think we're going to be there for a very long time in a very direct way, shape or form. I think that no one should really kid themselves that somehow there's going to be a handover in June and that's going to be the end of the affair. I think if you listen to most of the most senior members of the Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad, you will hear in their voices an admission that we are only at the very first step of an interim period in Iraq. And the story of the last 12 months has really been an attempt by Britain and the United States to put flesh on the bones of what regime change means to ordinary Iraqis. We got a glimpse of what regime change meant, I think, to London and Washington on that day when the statue came down. But what regime change really means to ordinary Iraqis, their ability and their desire to move beyond the trauma of the last 25 years is still being worked out, and it's still very, very unclear. So that's the context in which I wanted to write this book in my own way, to try and reflect back to people what the hopes and aspirations of ordinary Iraqis were as a result of this war, some of the things they believe the war has achieved for them, but the disappointments they have in what it hasn't achieved. And also, I think, a reflection back of just how rich, complicated, difficult, frustrating Iraqi society is. It is not, as I'm sure many of you must have thought in whenever you sort of read articles or thought about or talked amongst yourselves about Iraq, not a country that was about one man and one particular brutal regime. Iraq is an enormously complicated, rich, diverse, difficult society. It spans from its main urban areas, from the northern city of Mosul down to Basra, extremely educated and once very privileged people who studied in universities here in Britain and in Europe and the United States, and whose children had also, who holidayed all over Western Europe too, communities in rural areas that have not really moved beyond, I suppose, what many of us would have envisaged, the early parts of the 20th century in terms of economic development, access to health and hygiene and education. It spans everything. It's a country that has 4,000 years of recorded history, that has many different shades of Christianity, a tiny, tiny remnants of a Jewish community, and many different strains of Islam, from mystical Sufism to Shias to Sunni Muslims. And more than anything else, I really feel, more than I did even back in the summer when I wrote this book, knowing exactly what I wanted to do, I felt then that, in some senses, not just the epitaphs of certain political leaders, but to a certain extent, a very important stage in our sort of our country's history was going to be defined in Iraq by this engagement. I feel that very much, but I think it's going to be defined by ordinary Iraqis and how they respond to the occupation. I think it's not going to be written in London and Washington, and it's not going to be written through, you know, a lot of policy statements, policy theories, new initiatives. It's going to be written by ordinary Iraqis, which is why I think we need to hear the diversity and different voices of Iraq. So thank you very much for listening, and I'll come and join Adrian and take any questions that you want to ask about Iraq, before the war and since.
Right, you've got to do the work from here on in. So I'll look for hands being raised. Have we got people around with the microphones? Where are the people with the microphones? Can you make yourself? There's one. This chap down here. And was there somebody over there as well up on that side? Who had a hand up over there? Was there a... Oh, there's a chap down there. We'll take him next. Do you want to... Try not to talk right into the microphone, if you can avoid it, possibly, please.
What are your thoughts on the amount of violence still going on in Iraq? The causes, maybe who's,
sure.
Who's carrying it out, the reasons why, what they hope to gain?
Okay. It's a very, very critical question in many different ways. And I think one of the things that is quite clear is that Iraq is not just simply the new sort of battleground in the war on terror. It is a recruiting ground for a huge number of different organizations that come under the enormous umbrella, which is Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is not one direct sort of group or cell. It is a much more amorphous and large association, if you could call it like that, of militant sort of groups. It's hard to talk in specific terms about who these groups are and where they're from, but I think the evidence, such as it is at the moment, independent evidence, is that there is, on the one hand, a massive influx of foreign fighters, and I mean, I've seen them, and many other colleagues have seen them, from Yemen, from Algeria, and Lebanon. Those are the three nationalities that I've seen, and also homegrown Iraqi groups, which are often not actually of a religious bent, but just much more in terms of, I suppose, much more nationalist bent. They're just often made up of former regime loyalists, but who just want to drive American and British occupiers out. And I suppose what they want to inherit is just much more of what could be described as a warlordism, a sense in which they control swathes of area because of kinship and tribal links. So it's a very large myriad group of organizations that are doing it. But why they're doing it is critical. And it may seem, when you look at the sort of scenes, for example, from Karbala last week, or the United Nations, the bombing of the United Nations headquarters in Baghdad in August of last year, as somehow not just sort of brutal and savage, but also I suppose undirected. What is it that they're bombing? I mean, they bomb Iraqis, for example. I mean, the Iraqi police and the army. They bomb humanitarian organizations, the Red Cross and the United Nations, and they bomb religious festivals. You know, why would these Iraqi groups and so-called foreign Islamist fighters be doing that? Well, there's a very clear reason. It's not mindless and savage. It has a very cold and devastatingly effective logic. And if you look at the series of attacks in the last year, every time that London and Washington have sought to move the occupation forward on different fronts is when these groups have struck. In the summer, if you remember, there are a lot of calls to George W. Bush in particular, to internationalize the situation, particularly in humanitarian terms. The summer heat was at its most ferocious. There were real serious concerns, particularly in the Basra area, about cholera. Water wasn't getting through, etc. So what do these groups do? They bomb the United Nations and the Red Cross, and then when steps are made to try and withdraw the occupation forces, to hand over effective policing or policing effectively to Iraqi groups, the police and the army, nascent Iraqi police and the army, is bombed, and so forth. And the reason, the logic behind it is that it keeps the occupation behind the barbed wire that it's in, it provides less avenue of escape. Escape's perhaps the wrong word. Avenue of withdrawal for Britain and the United States. Every time they try to internationalize it, bring the United Nations in a humanitarian way, that's brought back. You know, let's hand power back. Let's get our soldiers back and hand power to the Iraqi police. Then the police are bombed, and it is ruthlessly efficient. Sadly.
There's a question over there.
Hi. Yeah. I'd just like to know that with the... I'd just like to know your opinion that with the ongoing democratic transition in Iraq, or as it's called, do you believe that democracy is possible for Iraq, for a country like Iraq, and do you think that this can be used in a wider sense to spread democratization for the Middle East?
I've got no... I mean, however sort of pessimistic, I mean, what I'm saying may sound to you, and I don't mean to be. I'm not completely pessimistic. I think democracy is more than possible in Iraq. I mean, I've met over the last 6 years enormous numbers of Iraqis who yearn for the kind of freedoms that we... you know, take for granted in the West. I don't think there's no sort of disconnect between Iraqis and the ideas of freedom and democracy. I think the patience that ordinary Iraqis have shown over the last year, despite all the problems with the occupation, is enormous testimony to that. I think the problem is when the idea of democracy and its introduction to a country is done for ideological reasons, and that's the problem. When I mean, journalistically, my sort of the hairs on the back of my head start to stand up is when there's a ideological program that, you know, it's going to be a domino effect. We start with Iraq, and then democracy is going to spread like it did in Eastern Europe in 1989, and you know, all the sheikhdoms in the Gulf will fall, and Iran will be next. I mean, that I find is, well, it's not just simplistic, but it's just not practical. So I've got no doubt that democracy can work. It's not going to be democracy in the initial sense that you and I understand it, in a sort of Westminster model. I think that the transitional arrangement or authority elections won't necessarily be successful. And I wonder whether elections, direct elections in the way we have them, is what's A, practical, or B, needed. I think what Iraqis want is a council that is representative and also accountable. That's the key thing, I think. I mean, and I think that's the bedrock, the acid test that is going to be required in Iraq. Not this idea that, you know, there's going to, you know, a Westminster model of democracy. So democracy is possible. There are many Iraqis who yearn for it, who have died for it, to be honest, in their thousands. It's just the options that they're helped with in building that democracy. That's the key thing.
There's a chap there with his hand up. Any other questioners on this side of the room?
Gentlemen.
We'll take that chap there first. Okay.
I was just going to ask how much the ordinary, everyday Iraqi citizen on the street, so to speak, was aware of the massive sort of divisions about the war in the West, the kind of the divisions over going to war. To what extent were people on the streets aware of that?
Before the war, they were aware because Iraqi television often ran a lot of the demonstrations in London, San Francisco, New York, all over Europe, all around the world. And it was presented by Iraqi TV, I mean, under Saddam Hussein, as you know, look, you know, the people around the world love us, you know, and they don't want a war to, you know, against our sort of brave leadership and so forth. So, I mean, of course, Iraqis saw through that, but they were very much aware of the demonstrations around the world. In terms of the continued division since the war, I'm not sure, I have to be honest. There's been an explosion, particularly in urban areas, of access to independent media. I mean, from the Arab world, from international TV stations. There's a huge press, you know, number of newspapers in Baghdad. And they see, particularly in Baghdad, news from many different perspectives, from the Arab perspective through things like Al Jazeera or Al Arabiya or Abu Dhabi TV, through international, as I say, Western sort of stations, BBC, CNN, etc., and their own newspapers. But the key question is how that, what ordinary Iraqis have ever felt that this public concern, public action on the streets in capitals all around the Western world was going to make a difference to them. And I think, I mean, I would say, and I say this on the basis of just a few discussions with Iraqi friends, they felt a huge gap between the position they're in and the concerns of ordinary people about the war around the rest of the world.
How do the ordinary Iraqis feel about hatred or liking the English or the Westerners?
Mm.
Is it true that they really hate in the West, because that comes over a lot on television?
Whether Iraqis hate us?
Yeah.
No, I've never ever felt that. I mean, whether that is the case now, it's something that is beginning to show itself over the last few months, because I haven't been in Iraq since really the end of last year, autumn of last year, because I've been writing the book. I'm not aware. I've never sort of heard that. What I can tell you is that, I mean, over the 6 years that I've been traveling through Iraq, and particularly the years under sanctions, when those Iraqis who travel to the West, and to this country as well, I mean, Iraq is by far, it's the most Anglophile country in the Middle East, without a shade of doubt, even more than, say, Egypt or the Palestinian or Jordanian Transjordan, which is the other sort of other country that has always been had close links with the UK. When sanctions really wiped the middle classes out in a very, very real sense, economically, and also sanctions at the same time imposed a very, very deep isolation amongst this sort of intellectual urban elite in Iraq, those who not only traveled to the West but had done business in the West, who went to British and American universities, who read, you know, shared a lot of cultural links with Britain, loved, you know, the culture here, read, you know, English or Western books, imposed a really deep sense of cultural isolation. I never felt there was any hatred of Britain. Iraqis have always shown this amazing ability, in my personal experience, to distinguish however they felt about a government and a citizen of that country. And I think the most the graphic example of that was of the three or four weeks during the war in Baghdad. I mean, I never heard of a single British or American journalist in Baghdad, and there were a large number of the 100 or so journalists who remained in Baghdad were British and American. When we had gone to the mortuaries, when we went to speak to the doctors and the relatives after bombings, when we went to the funerals, and people asked us where we were from, what organizations we're from, no one even raised their voices, let alone spat at us or anything else. Not ever. And that was true of the war, and that was true when I was there in 1998 in December, just before Christmas of 98. I don't know if any of you remember when the UN weapons inspectors were kicked out, and there was 4 days of bombardment, Operation Desert Fox, as it was called. Similarly, nothing at all. I've never experienced any sense of sort of hatred. And I think one of the questions immediately after I came back from Baghdad that people in this country wanted to ask me is, you know, how, you know, it must have been very, very, very dangerous. And it was, in the sense, it was very dangerous because we were in a city that was being bombed in a way that few other sort of cities in modern experience have been. But the danger was not personal. It wasn't to us as Westerners or British citizens. One never felt that at all from people in the regime or ordinary Iraqis. So I don't think that's true. I don't think it's something that we will need to sort of come to fear. And they distinguish, as I say, a hatred of a government's policy, but they can distinguish between that and a citizen of that country.
There's a very there's an amusing anecdote where you go to the site of a bombing in the book, and the kids who are there, the witnesses, want to ask you about Manchester United.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's very true. Yeah, I mean, it, at times it was sort of disconcerting. I mean, and it can seem sort of bizarre as well. And I remember also, I mean, before, just in the weeks before the war, I mean, there's a street in Baghdad called Mutanabi Street, which is where it's a street where secondhand books are sold, and the whole street is just carpeted every Friday, just, you know, from side to side with books. And you find, you know, very old copies of things like, I mean, Western classics, and, you know, Dickens and sort of George Eliot and so forth, and old copies of Time magazine and National Geographic and so forth. But there were huge posters as well of sort of, you know, Premiership sort of teams and Shoots magazine from 1987 and so forth. And I just remember sort of asking these young Iraqi kids, you know, and I thought it was a sort of a sort of perceptive question, you know, well, British bombs are about to fall on the city, you know, how come you really like British football teams? And they just looked at me as though I was an idiot and just said, well, because you've got one of the best leagues in the world. And it suddenly made a lot of sense.
More questions? By the way, the central block is not designated as a no-question zone. I'd just like to make that clear. Anybody in the middle like to ask a question in the interests of fairness and balance? Oh, yes, there's somebody there in the middle row. And who would? And then there's, if you head up there, there's a hand up there. So we'll take this one in the middle first. Break the duck.
Hi.
Hi.
I'd just like to ask, looking at sort of your introduction there, as to whether the war was a good thing or not. Mm. How do you think it would have played out if the British forces and American forces hadn't gone in? Do you think regime would have changed, or do you think it sort of continued? And I want to get your opinion on that.
Yeah, it's very hard, it's very difficult to try and look back and see what might have happened in Iraq without the sort of prism of September the 11th, because I think that's such a central issue in all of this. And even hearing the speech by the Prime Minister the other day, that came through very much, that September the 11th really did change the world in a fundamental way, and you know, the views of governments about international security, terrorism, etc. But having said that, I think I believe very much that what we would have seen would have been a continuation of the policy of containment, as it was called. And if you remember back, and we were talking earlier of 1998, when the weapons inspectors were kicked out of Baghdad and there were 4 days of airstrikes. I remember, I mean, I was in Baghdad then. The Prime Minister said, you know, Saddam Hussein is in a cage. You know, through the continued application of UN sanctions, his sort of international isolation as a pariah, the head of a pariah state, and the threat of continued airstrikes, you know, he is no longer the regional menace and threat. And the Prime Minister quite rightly said that UN inspections until then, with the previous weapons inspections process known by the different acronym of UNSCOM, had disarmed him very effectively in the mid-90s, particularly of the sort of biological weapons program. So I think containment would have been maintained and continued with, but things are different now. Yeah. Sure. Mm.
Well, I think there's amongst ordinary Iraqis, I think there's a sort of trepidation about this interim period. I think only now, it's been 11 long months, the first sort of signs of what an interim government will look like, and you know, a constitution is yet to be worked out, but they have a sort of a constitution and a government for the sort of interim period, which will take Iraqis 2 or 3 years hence to, you know, full sovereign government that they can elect themselves. The problem, I think, the trepidation, that's great, that's good. It's been a long time in coming. It's taken 11 months to work all of this out. That's great. You know, better late than never. But the problem in the meanwhile has been that in that void over the last 11 weeks, what we were talking about at the beginning of this Iraq now being a magnet for these other Islamist groups, is in danger of derailing that, to the extent that there seems to be no answer that the coalition has to provide. I mean, democracy needs security in order to sort of live and grow. You know, you can't have talk about notions of sort of freedom and sovereign governments when, you know, bombs are going off all over the place. You're terrified to let your children out of the door. There are untold numbers of, you know, one of the things I've not even heard of at the moment, so bad is the situation, is the absolutely rampant nature of criminality in Baghdad. I mean, you know, there's a huge industry of kidnappings of middle-class children. It's just a straightforward, you know, business transaction. You know, anyone who has, you know, a wealthy or middle-class Iraqi, their child is kidnapped, and you get your child back, if you're lucky, for £100. I mean, it's as simple as that. But it's sort of almost completely overlooked. But within that kind of atmosphere, democracy becomes near impossible. And the dangers are that whilst some kind of flesh is put onto the development of a sovereign Iraqi state, it's being done in sort of such a vacuum and in a fitful way that those people who have most to lose by that emergence of that state are, you know, having the best opportunity to derail it.
Good question up there.
Hello.
At a nightmare scenario, I think there's plenty of other issues and factors that could lead to civil conflict, civil war in Iraq. That's there. I mean, we shouldn't hide from that. It's a very real possibility. But I have never really subscribed to this sort of notion of Iraq being made up of a strict sort of schism between a, you know, clearly identifiable Shia South, clearly identifiable Sunni center. I do ascribe to a clearly identifiable Kurdish North, because it's been an autonomous region anyway for 10 years. Now, Iraqi society is much more complicated than that. I think where the splits are between, I suppose, the urban, mercantile, middle-class centers and the provinces. You know, Ayatollah al-Sistani's, you know, heartland of support, the Shia, the preeminent Shia leader in Iraq, is in the rural provinces around in the south. It's not necessarily in the city center of Najaf or amongst Shias in Baghdad. I mean, put it this way: I think a Shia merchant in Baghdad has a lot more in common with a Kurdish middle-class businessman in Baghdad than that Shia would have with another Shia in a rural village outside of Karbala. Do you see the point I'm making? It's much more about a sort of an urban and provincial sort of split. And I think the proof of the pudding in that is that if you look at the responses amongst the clergy in response, are following on from the outrages in Karbala, you've seen Sunni and Shia clerics, quite senior ones, saying, we know what this outrage is intended to do, that part of the aim is to try and foment deeper schisms and therefore the prospect of violence between our communities, but we're not going to let that happen. Because those kind of schisms don't exist, and B, because I think Iraqis very bravely want to continue and have the prospect of ushering in a sovereign state despite the failures of the occupation and the violence of those who tried to derail it.
Thank you. I know a lot of the questions so far have been about the bigger political question, and I'm very happy to take those if you want to ask them. One thing that intrigued me reading the book was just how scared you felt because the offices of Al Jazeera were bombed, possibly deliberately, by the United States, and then the hotel that you were staying in was also hit by serious weaponry, and you must have been, you know, all political considerations aside, you must have been scared witless.
No, you were, and I never tried to sort of hide it at all. I think the war, from a sort of personal perspective, was, even though a lot of us had who remained in Baghdad had covered other conflicts, it was entirely different even before the conflict had begun in terms of the psychological impact of preparing for it. And I think that was probably a reflection that we all knew just how enormous it was in sort of, not just a sort of as an event in itself, but just the ramifications and its sort of place in history. I mean, the consequences of this war, was it was really a defining issue for a lot of the central questions at the, you know, at the heart of our world. And we'd obviously taken a lot of the sort of precautions, or our news organizations had, that, you know, has been the case quite often in other conflicts over the last few years, and both the Ministry of Defense and the Pentagon had direct satellite coordinates for where all the different Western media were. They knew the exact coordinates of the Al Jazeera office. Many senior executives had been to the Ministry of Defense and had been to the Pentagon to speak directly and say, look, here's where our guys are going to be. Now, one must be sort of realistic. There's a very large difference between a tank commander on the Jumhuriya Bridge and his actions in firing a tank shell at the Palestine Hotel than a guy sitting at the Pentagon who's spoken to, you know, lots of foreign editors and said, don't worry, no, we're going to pass this down the chain. You know, they're going to know exactly where you guys are. And one has to be realistic. But the thing that gave me a very sort of particular take was that I had been in Kabul in November of 2001 when the Al Jazeera office there was bombed as well. And that was it's public knowledge now, that was absolutely directly targeted and specific. They were phoned up, they were given half an hour to get out of their office, and two missiles were directed from two American warplanes specifically at the Al Jazeera office. That evening, the BBC, a house adjacent to the BBC office where I and three other BBC colleagues were, was hit. Our next door neighbor opposite was the Taliban mayor of Kabul. And one missile just came in very surgically, hit his house, but was very careful to avoid the BBC. So these things are very, very carefully controlled, is what I'm saying. So, and in the terrible incidents where Tariq Ayub, the Al Jazeera correspondent, was killed, I mean, that was one particular a missile. So it wasn't as those three that just one goes astray. And you can make sense of this. You know, when it's just one particular missile on a building, that looks very suspicious. If it's sort of random fire over an area, you can sometimes, force yourself to sort of believe that that's just what, you know, part of the cost of war. It just happens. It happens to civilians and it also happens to journalists. But it was one tank round. What the reasons for that tank firing on the Palestine Hotel, I don't know. Because the initial reasons that there was fire coming from the Palestine Hotel where the journalists were is simply not true. And, you know, there were many news organizations recording this tank for half an hour
before. I mean, French television, BBC, Sky News. And going back on the soundtrack of those that footage, you know, there's not a single sound of any weapon. I mean, in the whole area of the Palestine Hotel, let alone inside it. But it was a very, very frightening war to report on. And a very costly one as well for journalists.
We'll take that chap there, and then we'll take the person there in the red up there. So, we've got one person doing two jobs there. I think we'll have to go to this person up here first. Sorry.
And what were your feelings on the warning that we heard that Saddam Hussein had been captured? And how would you like him to be brought to justice?
I remember very clearly I was at home on the morning, on a Sunday of December the 13th, and someone called me up about 9 o'clock and said, listen, it may not come to anything, it probably is, you know, not true, but we've just been called from Baghdad to say there are rumors that Saddam Hussein has been caught, but listen, you know, don't put your Sunday plans on hold. Then 45 minutes later saying, look, we're really, think he's sort of being caught. And there was a huge sort of rumor mill, and the Coalition Provisional Authority was, you know, putting the word about. So I went to the BBC, and about an hour later, 2 hours later, it was confirmed that he'd been caught. And I remember looking at the television screens when Paul Bremer, the American administrator, held his press conference and said, ladies and gentlemen, we've got him. And it was only really when I saw that footage of Saddam Hussein with his long sort of beard and being, you know, the American medic poking around his mouth, you know, to give him an inspection, and also, of course, to get his DNA through the spatula to take it in. Now, a lot of that was just my own personal sort of. It seemed extraordinary. I mean, after so many years of reporting on Iraq and following his career and his crimes and his self-delusional sort of mythology that he'd built up around him, to see him sort of in such a tawdry end was shocking, because it seemed that one of these lies that he had told about himself must be true. I mean, anyone who'd been in Iraq to that extent thought that, you know, this idea of him as a messianic sort of leader that was going to die with his boots on in a sort of, you know, huge gunfight at the end with the enemy invaders. I mean, as his two sons had done, he'd urged, you know, Iraqis to resist the occupation. Something must have been true, and of course it wasn't. It was just sort of one last lie was revealed about it. But what effect has his capture had? Well, look at it in terms of from the view of ordinary Iraqis. I mean, the most important thing is, I mean, where does the sort of the emergence of identity for a nation, you know, come from, you know, after, you know, the laying to rest of this horrendous nightmare of the past. That's one thing that his capture could have represented for ordinary Iraqis. But how possible is that, given what is happening on the streets of many Iraqi cities anyway? So that hasn't been a reality. Speaking to friends in Baghdad, it's almost as though his capture just isn't an issue anymore. I mean, I haven't had a conversation with one friend who sort of, we talk about Saddam's capture, he's coming up for trial, they were going to, psychological healing is going to happen. It's not. I mean, the issue is always about other things. So Iraqis have sort of moved on. And the other thing that is peculiar is that, you know, Saddam Hussein was such an obsession from the point of view of London and Washington. He was the man who was really at the heart of, you know, the concealment of weapons of mass destruction. Only a tiny sort of hand-picked sort of inner core knew this sort of secrets. Now, he's being debriefed for months now, and yet complete silence. I mean, if something extraordinary revelation, you know, would have emerged from the debriefing, you'd think that it'd be, you know, there would be leaks. Do you see what I mean? And that's the thing I find puzzling. I mean, is he just not saying anything? What is he revealing? I mean, I'm really intrigued to know, because I mean, if absolutely fundamental secrets that explain what happened to these weapons of mass destruction, or, you know, where the sort of the real mass graves were, it would have come out. And the interesting thing was,
You remember Paul Bremer at his arrest? He was said, General Sanchez, who's the chief American military officer, said, Saddam Hussein, the prisoner, is being cooperative. You remember that? But then strangely, when the most senior Iraqis, who were members of the council, were taken to meet him, 2 hours later, they came back saying, you know, he is utterly unreconstructed. You know, he was spitting defiance. He sort of said that, and they put to him these accusations. You know, there are thousands of people, you know, buried in mass graves. And he said, I was a just but firm ruler. Well, what about people celebrating your capture in Baghdad? I mean, have you not seen the sort of television pictures? And Saddam replied, they're hired gangs. So, I mean, I think they had a very good take on what Saddam Hussein was going to be like in debriefing rather than General Sanchez.
I think part of the question as well was, what would you like to see?
I think he needs to be tried in Iraq. I think, I mean, it's... but that... It raises more questions than it answers. I mean, Human Rights Watch recently did a survey about the Iraqi judiciary. I mean, the Human Rights Watch is a very large American-based human rights group that has done amazing work, particularly on Iraq, going back all the way to the late 1980s, when they issued and tried to get international support for the indictment of Saddam Hussein and met with absolutely stony silence in virtually every Western capital when he didn't have the kind of identity that he does now. And did in the 90s, they found that of all the judges, Iraqi judges that they found, the guy who the longest trial that any of them had presided over had lasted a day and a half. So the idea, he needs to be tried by Iraqis in Baghdad, but that's not practical. So at what stage does international involvement, you know, become, you know, a Western sort of show trial? I mean, it raises all kinds of very difficult questions. But in an ideal world, he should be tried in Iraq by Iraqis.
We'll take that question of there, but I think there was a chap here first. If you want to, you're on overtime, if you want to. Sorry, poor chap's missing out.
Yeah,
again.
Good evening, Raggy.
Good evening.
Between 1982 and 86, I spent a lot of time in Baghdad,
okay.
Selling construction products, mm-hmm. basically. Involved with several projects, but one of them was a Council of Ministers building.
Oh, yeah.
Which carried out Mariam, just across the river from
Tigris River, yeah.
I just wondered. It looked like a step towards democracy back in those times. Mm. I wonder if was there any democracy, or was it, you know, any democratic
it's
thing
interesting.
Was the building ever used in any democratic way, and is it still there?
I mean, I think when Saddam, it's very interesting, I mean, particularly from 1982, because Saddam had only come to sort of ascend it to absolute power really in sort of 79-80. And thereafter began his drive to sort of attain absolute control over the Ba'ath Party. But the Ba'ath Party until then was still largely made up of a broad swathe of, I suppose, the best and the brightest from Iraq and middle classes. What Saddam Hussein's bastardization of the Ba'ath Party in some ways, I mean, and how he managed to get complete and absolute grip on it, was that he brought his tribal and familial links from the areas around Tikrit, he brought, you know, that sort of tribal instincts to Baghdad and into the Ba'ath Party. So, you know, people sort of say, well, you know, look at the Ba'ath Party and they see the likes of Tariq Aziz, you know, these very sort of very bright, very well sort of traveled, sort of in some senses malevolent sort of people, and think that's the Ba'ath Party. No, it's not. I mean, the Ba'ath Party, the pillars of the regime were more like Ali Hassan al-Majid, you know, Chemical Ali, and all these other people who had direct tribal and feudal links tribal and familiar links with Saddam Hussein. So, to answer your question, very little remains of those sort of democratic instincts. I mean, in terms of the old families and merchant families that did have some involvement in the Ba'ath Party at the beginning of the 80s, but were effectively, at best, sidelined, more often exiled or killed. Look at the Iraqi exile community now. I mean, the Iraqi exile leadership, I should say, not the community. That's two very different things. Look at the Iraqi exile leadership. I mean, virtually everyone was at some stage in the Ba'ath Party, driven out. They were the old sort of families, and you know, the from the privileged, you know, best and the brightest, if you like, who were driven out of the party and then into exile. I think it doesn't sort of necessarily mean that, you know, because they were all at one time in the Ba'ath Party, they're all, you know, evil henchmen. I think some of them actually are, but not all of them. I don't think it necessarily means just because they were in the Ba'ath Party. In the same way that the Director General of the Iraqi Ministry of Health, you know, was a member of the Ba'ath Party because he had to be. But I mean, I don't know the guy, but I should think that it's not the same as a man who was the sort of a senior commander in the Special Republican Guard. I think they're two different things. I mean, Ba'ath Party does not automatically spell, you know, every single one is evil, because nurses had to be members of the Ba'ath Parties.
The buildings that we saw so much bombs and you know, every night. How much of the, you know, how many public buildings are really left?
Well, quite a few are left. I mean, especially all the palaces have, of course, been rebuilt, and they're now American bases. I mean, from the Republican Palace, which is the biggest one. I mean, the night of sort of the most heavy bombardment during Shock and Awe, as it was seen from the Palestine Hotel, was looking out over that whole swathe from the Council of Ministers building across to the Republican Palace on the edge of the sort of Tigris River. And that was the sort of monumental heart, if you like, of Baghdad, or Saddam Hussein's Baghdad. I think what had a terrible, terrible effect was the uncontrolled arson after the city fell of virtually every single ministry. And that was... It really was beyond me as to why that was allowed to happen. And I mean, I write in the book, I mean, why I think it did happen, which is that there was a sort of belief, I think, in the euphoria of the fall of Baghdad. When we did see the looting of the private homes of the senior regime members, that this was, and I think, you know, most people in this room would sort of think that, you know, ordinary Iraqis impoverished by years of sanctions going off and making off with the crockery from, you know, Saddam's half-brother's house is, you know, to be expected and, to be expected and accepted. And that sort of thing. And I went all around a lot of sort of houses that were being looted. It was a very orderly affair. I mean, it was a family affair as well. I mean, there was sort of... the whole sort of parking lot, the street was sort of cut off outside. I mean, for example, Watban Ibrahimi's house, who was the sort of half-brother of former Minister of Interior. There were, you know, mothers with their children, and they were seeing what was left of, you know, in the kitchen, nothing. Well, let's go upstairs. Maybe these doors can come off, and, you know, can we get someone to help us carry it down? It was all sort of fine, you know. But what... The American soldiers, who were sort of more, you know, really sort of quite terrified of and, you know, they'd been shot at. They were still in a dangerous city, a strange city, and they were just looking out for remnants of the regime. That was all fine. You know, the looting, that doesn't matter. They're not a military threat, and hey, besides, it's a good thing. You know, they're ripping off the guys who've been ripping them off for years, basically. But then all those bands of militias who'd done most of the fighting in Basra and Nasiriyah and Samawa and all these other areas, those who'd put up the stiffest resistance, who were most allied to Saddam Hussein, who were dressed also in civilian uniforms, and who had prepared a scorched earth policy for the occupation forces, just went into the ministries and in an attempt to deny a new government, just went and torched all these buildings. But the Americans, who were in control of Baghdad, thought, well, this is all part of the general looting, and it's to be accepted. So, you know, up went in smoke, you know, the Ministry of Trade, the Ministry of Irrigation, the Ministry of Health, the Ministry of, I mean, you name it, you know, every single sort of thing was just torched, and that was pure arson. There was no that was not looting, but it had a disastrous effect, because how can you run a country if all the ministries of, you know, and infrastructure have been completely torched?
We'll take this chap down here in a moment. He's been waiting a long time, but speed, was there a questioner there?
Prior to regime change, what impact did being a member of the Ba'ath Party have on an ordinary person, for example, a nurse or a teacher? And does the Ba'ath Party maintain any influence now?
The Ba'ath Party is hated in Iraq now, but I'm talking about the Ba'ath Party in terms of the 3,000, I think it was probably between about 2,000 or 3,000 that were the real pillars of the party. And the Ba'ath Party membership ran to about 4 or 5 million people, but the true leadership of the Ba'ath Party at its most sort of ruthless extent probably extended to about 2,000 to 3,000 people, I should think. Well beyond this idea that it was just 55 guys on a deck of cards that ran the whole of Iraq. That element of the Ba'ath Party, those men who were the architects of the regime and who made it function at state level, is what is hated. I don't think that simple membership of the Ba'ath Party is singles you out for hatred. I mean, if you look at this, there's no sort of public lynchings or anything like that of you, because to be anything in Iraq, you had to be a member of the Ba'ath Party. It was part of the brutalization of the regime that it made you give up your identity in some senses in this way, and that was one of the small cruelties of it. So the Ba'ath Party is hated, but and no Iraqi will ever support the return of any group that they believe symbolizes a return of Ba'athism. But the Ba'ath Party, as representing these 2,000 to 3,000 people, I mean, that's my sort of, I mean, depends, you know, who you read, but I mean, on the whole, I think of most people who know a lot about Iraq, I think sort of 2,000 to 3,000 people is what is generally agreed as a sort of the beating heart of the party. That's hated, but not the idea of individual Iraqis having joined the party in order to gain some sort of advancement. And it's not petty advancement, it's to fulfill, you know, one's training and you know, become doctors, engineers, whatever. It took an enormous amount of bravery for people not to be members of the party. I mean, I knew one of them, and is very much at the heart of the book, a man called Muhammad Darwish, who's one of my sort of closest friends in Iraq. Because it somehow sort of marked you out, obviously, for the ever sort of pervasive number of secret police agencies that were a reality in Iraq under Saddam Hussein.
During your lengthy stay in Iraq, were you always free to report the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but, or were you ever put under any pressure?
No, we're under. Yeah, it's you. No, we're under pressure, of course, but not direct pressure. I think I spell it out in the book. The idea that I mean, censorship was not direct in Iraq in the sense that you had to submit each and every one of your reports before you could broadcast it. That never happened. During the war, that only happened once to me, and that was on the first day of the war. But after that, no Iraqi ever saw any of my reports or my two other BBC colleagues, and never saw any of our scripts, never saw any of the pictures, and never sat in on any of our live broadcasts. The image probably was in most people's sort of, you know, the mind's eye here, that it was a very direct and careful sort of censorship, that we were having to sort of have all of our reports were being monitored. It was much more chaotic and disorganized because it was a thuggish regime, and it just dealt on the basis of occasional threats to make sure that, you know, somehow you were you were psychologically sort of self-censoring, I suppose, in a lot of ways. That's what it sort of depended on. And at the same time, to a certain extent, they didn't need to censor you directly because such was the terror and fear amongst ordinary Iraqis that Iraqis censored themselves to a large extent, unless you had been traveling there for a long time and had built up kind of relationships, and they could only be few, that where you could talk to Iraqis privately and know what they felt and what they were saying. And the only way to report that accurately was by, I suppose, editorializing. Much easier to be able to do it in a newspaper where you could say, you know, sources, you know, etc. It's harder to do it on television because in television you're normally used to seeing a clip by someone sitting, Abdul so-and-so told me, you know, he was afraid of, he was looking forward to, you know, a new government in Iraq, but was very fearful about the effects of the war. And then you see a clip. That wasn't possible. I had to editorialize it by my own live comments. Whenever studio presents ask me, well, you know, what's happening or what do you feel that ordinary Iraqis think, I would take these private conversations and obviously leaving the names and identities of people out and try and broadcast it back. But of course, the one thing, and I know this was an issue from the government here, saying that, you know, journalists were not sort of saying, identifying enough that they were under a brutal sort of a dictatorship, and they couldn't say, you know, how much a mass murderer Saddam Hussein was. Well, that's true. I mean, you couldn't get up on TV and say, Saddam Hussein, a mass murdering psychopath today, said his government would, etc., etc., because you'd be slung out of the country. So that was where the sort of censorship came in. But, I mean, you know, each and every one of my reports, and the only way to get around it, I mean, we've had lots of sort of discussions within the BBC, was to sort of try and get across the idea that, yes, we were reporting from a country that was under a dictatorship, but yet we're not under direct censorship. So how do we do that? And I think this sort of announcements before any report from Baghdad, you know, has been subject to monitoring, was the most honest and direct way of conveying the kind of restrictions we're under. But it was a thuggish, disorganized regime, and it was in this fashion that its attempts to control Western journalists worked. But under the war, there wasn't, you know, it was even more disorganized.
But at any time did the BBC themselves, probably via the government or vice versa, put you under any pressure to put it in such a way that it seemed as though what the British and the Americans were doing was right?
Was right, yeah. No, I didn't. Yeah. No, not at all. I mean, it's a matter of public record that there were huge numbers of complaints from Number 10 about our presence, I mean, in the BBC in Baghdad. But, I mean, I just heard of it in a very indirect way when senior editors wanted to know, look, you know, what kind of censorship are you from, under how, you know, much, so that they had a defense to with which to respond to. But 90% of the rest of the time, I was just left to, you know, I wasn't told, oh, we got 7 letters from Number 10 today or 5 phone calls. They just said, look, just get on with your job and report exactly in the way that you feel you have to. I mean, I'd come across it in Kabul as well. That was much more direct, actually, and much more extreme, sort of asking from, you know, saying that, I mean, my presence and William Reeves' presence. Because up until then, there'd only been Al Jazeera in Kabul until we went in, that we shouldn't be there. We should sort of be pulled out somehow. But no, I mean, it didn't make any difference to us.
Is that? You've spotted them better. Who's that person who's been trying since the very beginning?
Over there.
Sorry, sir, I do apologise. there's this chap down here as well is going to ask you next. That'll probably be the last 2 questions. Well, while it's been passed along, just very briefly, Raggy, talking about the censorship that you may have faced, was there a censorship in terms of story selection, given that you went to the town of Hilla and you interviewed Abdel Jawad, whose 6 sons had been killed by coalition forces? Nobody else reported that story.
No.
And it wouldn't have been reported unless you'd been there.
It was very, very difficult. I mean, to a certain extent, I suppose that is that was one of the sort of pitfalls. But it was more practical necessity, really. I mean, I was amazed that no one had really sort of, apart from when it happened, and there were a number of journalists who did go at the time, but since then, the whole issue of the use of cluster bomb munitions in civilian areas, particularly at its worst around Hilla, just outside of Baghdad, was not investigated, not just by journalists, but also by, I mean, either sort of human rights groups or military investigators, because there is a sort of system of compensation for civilians, Iraqi civilians who've been killed or maimed as a result of British and American bombardments. I don't know. I mean, there's just I don't know what the answer to that is. In some senses, there are so many other issues around the occupation, and particularly the continued violence in many different areas of Iraq, but particularly that central area around Baghdad, that the continued price ordinary Iraqis are paying, you're quite right, is overlooked too much.
Sorry for missing you out earlier. Okay.
Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam.
Raghi, you are an Englishman. You are an African Arab, and you've experienced life in a variety of what I would call hotspots, including Mogadishu in Somalia, South Africa, Ethiopia, Afghanistan, Iraq. What I want to know is, how have your experiences in these zones of conflict affected Raghi Omar himself as a person? But also, how do they affect your ability to be objective in your role as a journalist?
How have they affected me? I've gone there for professional reasons. That's how I've ended up in these sort of hotspots. And it'd be churlish of me to sort of stand in front of you and not pretend that, having gone through those experiences, looking back on them, I think they've made me a better human being, I believe. It sounds strange to say, especially going through such appalling experiences in lots of those places, but in the midst of them, you also go through very amazingly uplifting experiences. I mean, war is experiencing and chronicling conflicts is an experience where you see appalling acts of humanity side by side with very uplifting ones. You see the banal, you know, side by side with the tragic as well. At times, and it sounds strange to say, but sort of funny and touching moments, as well as moments which are very emotionally wrenching. So, I think it's made me a better person. It's made me a more objective journalist as well. And I think what it does is I made me less naive journalistically. And I think that I was asked recently about to contribute some comments to a much deserved tribute to the very famous BBC reporter Charles Wheeler. And I was asked, well, what do you really, why has he been someone you really respect and have held up? And I think the answer I gave, almost instinctively, was that he's got a very high bullshit detection antenna for a journalist. And I think more than ever now, we really need that. And I think that's probably what those experiences have given me. They've honed that antenna a bit more. I don't really believe things until I've gone to sort of see it for myself, and stereotypes that are presented, I sort of think there must be something very fishy. I'm being told someone is really, really, really bad, without having a sort of the experience of direct evidence. But psychologically, in terms of the cost to me, news organizations this day, being a sort of foreign correspondent is not the kind of sort of quite tribal macho thing that it perhaps was 15 sort of years ago. And the extraordinary thing in Baghdad, those who remained journalists, men and women, a very large number were husbands, wives, and parents, and they're not sort of people on a death wish who sort of lead these sort of constant sort of single sort of lives roaming sort of disaster spots. I don't think any of us, I'm not something that tries to sort of bury the sort of more difficult sort of things that one sees. I mean, if a lot of organizations now, when you come back from stories, however sort of routine, if you could use that word, you know, they offer you counseling, and I would take it if I thought I needed it, but I mean, it's not something I try to sort of put to the back.
Final question, sir.
Thanks. Someone's got to ask about the statue.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I bunked off work to buy a suit, and suddenly I heard your voice, and the whole store moved towards the TV screen. You stood there until it was all down. What was it like to be there at that moment, which is one of those sort of seminal historical moments? And what did you think when that American soldier attempted to put a Stars and Stripes over the head of the statue?
I felt... The coming down of the statue was preceded by what was, for me, probably one of the most sort of frightening moments of the whole war, which was going to meet the American soldiers, particularly because it had true, and the reason for it is, I mean, obviously the attack on the Palestine Hotel had happened 2 days before, and I'd witnessed the death of Taras Petrushk, who was the Reuters cameraman. And this was just as the war was ending, and I just thought, from a personal point of view, having known Taras not particularly well, but having worked with him as a colleague, that it seemed, I mean, it just was such a waste. I mean, having survived for that long, so I think all of us were feeling incredibly vulnerable, and the war had really, really just crashed literally into our lives at that moment in a very direct and horrendous way. Secondly. We had all the reference points, having sort of survived in Baghdad. We knew what it was like in Baghdad, what the dangers from the bombing were, all the sort of things, risks that you internalize, the little habits that you go through to make yourself, you know, less vulnerable. But we had no idea what it was going to be like meeting these young American soldiers. And we'd already seen, as they were fighting their way into Baghdad, that they were shooting at anything that they felt to be a risk. So myself, our bureau chief Paul Danahar, and the cameraman Duncan Stone and Dylan Nalid, who was our driver, we drove down the road east or southeast from the Palestine Hotel, where some of the Marine Division was coming. And there they were. But we drove at 5 miles an hour. We had all our protective clothing on. We'd taken bed sheets and were sort of, as all journalists were doing, sort of waving them out of the car, and you walk towards them, you walk with your hands out like that, and you are crouching, because to not do otherwise would be very dangerous. So I was, by the time that the Americans had driven into the square, I was just sort of completely exhausted and quite sort of, first times I'd sort of begun to allow myself to believe that it, from a personal point of view, sort of the end was in sight. And the pulling down of the statue just seemed to come out of nowhere. I mean, I think Iraqis sort of emerged a bit sort of bemused, because seeing American soldiers in Baghdad, from my point of view, having been in Iraq for 6 years, was indescribable. For Iraqis, it must have been like seeing sort of Martians. There was a sense of, who are these strange young sort of boys from this mythical land called America? And at first, Iraqis just wanted to show, and there was only about 200, if that. I mean, at first, it was only about 50. Just wanted to show that they could say something that they wanted to say. So, you know, down with Saddam Hussein. I mean, that was a huge psychological leap for them. I mean, whereas, those kind of acts would have certainly, at very best, bought imprisonment in the years. So I think that's where the sort of idea of toppling the statue came from. They wanted to reach for something to hand to sort of show that they could exercise these freedoms now. And sort of some rope emerged out of somewhere, I don't know where, that's a sort of weird thing, and they tried to tie it, an Iraqi had gone to the
statue to try and tie it around its ankles. But eventually the Americans saw a photo opportunity and got an armored personnel carrier up and decided to bring it down, especially when all the cameras were pointing at it. It still was utterly exhilarating because, you know, it wasn't the most important statue. I saw that statue being erected 11 months earlier. It was not the oldest statue. It was, you know, it was not the most important one. But there were similar scenes in Baghdad all through that day. Others much more important, especially in the Shia slums in northern Baghdad, where there were, you know, ceremonies that were much more moving, thousands of more people in attendance. But that's where the live cameras were. So that was the iconic moment that captured the end of Saddam's rule in Baghdad. And it was very emotional. It was very, very iconic. Because I thought here was the moment when Iraqis are going to sort of begin to lay the terrible trauma of the last sort of 25 years to an end. I was wrong, because the next day the new Iraq emerged in sort of the smoke and acrid fumes of the looting. But I felt sort of very, very exhilarated. I just got lost in the sea, I remember, when the statue sort of came down. I was with Andrew Kilrain, who was another one of the cameramen, and I never, every time I see his pictures of the statue coming down and bouncing towards him, it still sort of sends a complete shiver down my spine, because it's just so iconic, and seeing the statue just literally, and you see the crowds of young men sort of converging and jumping up on it. It was, you know, journalists often speak quite lazily of their jobs being a front row seat in history or the rough draft of history, but that was certainly a moment where, for once, it wasn't a cliche, I think.
Well, thank you. I've got to say I'm delighted that I spend my life in the comfy armchair of history. But if you want to know what it's like to be in the front seat, then Revolution Day, as I say, it'll be on sale at the back. 10% off, and Raghu will be signing it himself. But it is full of great human stories. That thing, that, nobody's paying me to say this, by the way. But just like Iraq of Saddam, where Raghu used to have to smuggle in English language novels to give to his friends, his translators and minders, which then had to be put into Arabic sleeves of instruction manuals so that nobody would know that his minders were actually reading English language material. It's full of loads of illuminating detail like that. I would say as well that Raghu, although he's kind of left the BBC officially, I think he will still be filing regular reports for BBC News and is due to go back for Panorama very shortly. You'll be able to see that on your television screen soon. And the last thing to say really is that on Tuesday, if you've enjoyed tonight, Michael Holroyd, the noted biographer, will be here reading from his latest set of memoirs. But for tonight, thank you very much, and thank you very much indeed, particularly to Raghu Omar.
Thank you very much. Thank you.